Welcome, everybody. Welcome to tonight's program with Inform at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Sarah Fryer. I'm a technology reporter for Bloomberg. And I'm pleased to be in conversation here with Dan, who's a PhD, award-winning neuroscientist, a New York Times best-selling author of books besides this book. There's a cell phone, but you know we'll acknowledge it. This Is Your Brain on Music was another book you did, The World in Six Songs, and The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And you are Dean of Arts and Humanities at Minerva Schools.
Social Sciences.
Oh, this is a...
I used to be
you
Dean
were,
of...
Okay, you were Arts and Humanities and you've switched.
Yeah, I switched.
We're getting some backstory.
Yeah.
So he recently published the book we're talking about today, which is A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age, which we all have seen a lot of fact-based debate in this election. We're all here to learn how to discern fact from fiction from him. So let's get started.
And from you.
Yes, yes. I'm a reporter, so I love discerning fact from fiction. That's kind of my job.
I'd just like to point out that Sarah is a bona fide reporter, and we're living in, I say that because we're living in an age when some networks and some broadcast outlets have realized that there's money in getting you riled up, and so they've blurred the lines between real journalism and entertainment and created infotainment or something like that, which is just a bunch of people yelling at each other and or yelling at you. And it's a real privilege to be sharing the stage with a genuine, serious professional journalist who
Thank
has
you.
the skills that you do.
Appreciate it. Well, I want to know what drove you to write this book. Because as I was reading it, you know, part of it reads sort of like a guide for how to mislead people if you really want to, so you can learn the tactics. but I'm sure that wasn't your intention for the takeaway. Who do you hope reads this book? How did you start thinking about writing it?
I started writing this book in 2001.
Okay.
And I started collecting examples from my students when I was teaching at McGill University. I taught a critical thinking class. And they would go to the newspapers or magazines. I got a whole lot from Fox News and U.S. News and World Distort. U.S. News and World Report. Just boxes and boxes of examples of misleading graphs and stuff. And I, in earnest, started writing the book in 2001 and then really doubled down in 2015.
Did you see sort of the percolating effects of misinformation on social media? Like, what was it that was really the spark?
Well, I think it was the realization that the primary mission of teachers had to change. We'd spent 100 or 200 years following a certain model where we fill young heads full of facts and you know, teachers would lecture and they would think of all the things you had to memorize when you were a kid, like Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, or...
You didn't learn that Columbus, you know, enacted genocide. You didn't learn any of that stuff, but you had to know the date.
That's right.
Really important.
Right. And the Declaration of Independence was signed July 4th, 1776.
Yes.
And George Washington was our first president, and he cut down a cherry tree. And 8 times 5 is 45, and the sun is 93 million miles away. It takes 8 minutes for light to get here. All these facts that we had to memorize. It's no longer necessary to do that, because any fact that you want to know, you can get in about half a second on a device that has more computational power than Apollo Mission Control had. You've got access to all of the world's information, all the world's libraries. So what I realize is that teachers have to stop pretending that education is about teaching facts and realize that it's about teaching students how to tell a fact from a pseudo-fact, how to analyze the information that they encounter, and then how to use that information in a creative way and in a way that will help make the world a better place.
What do you think of Wikipedia?
Well, so, you know, I have mixed feelings about it.
Because Wikipedia told me that that you were a recording engineer for Santana and the Grateful Dead. Is that a pseudo fact?
That's true.
It's true. Okay. Yeah. It's so rare that you get to confirm the Wikipedia facts with the person in the Wikipedia. So it just has a congratulations on your past.
Here's why I have mixed feelings about Wikipedia. When Lauren Sanger and Jimmy Wales founded Wikipedia, there was no one site repository of information on the web. Encyclopedia Britannica was behind a paywall and so on. Yeah. But in their statement, their mission statement, they said that Wikipedia would be a site where anybody could contribute and experts had no special standing. Now think about what that means, right? That an expert has no more right to contribute or update a page on Wikipedia than anybody else. So if you're reading an article on Wikipedia about, I don't know, how to perform brain surgery, it might have been written by a brain surgeon, but it might have been written by a 12-year-old looking at a 30-year-old textbook, or worse. You know, I mean, you just don't know. So their lack of respect for expertise was probably necessary in order to get it going, and it now is pretty much the de facto source for most information most people want to know. But it can be tremendously unreliable because just while we're sitting here talking, somebody can be going in and editing the pages that you normally visit, and you don't know who that person is. And it's designed that way. So I think that it's great in that it's making information free, and I believe in that. I've worked my whole life as an educator, and I believe that information is part of the public trust, that people should have access to. Public libraries are a great example of that. Public radio, like we're doing tonight. But the problem with Wikipedia is that you need to look very carefully at it. And that's part of what I want to teach people to do with this talk tonight and with the book.
So let's talk about a source that you do respect. You talked earlier with me about how you think the New York Times has very good fact-checking generally. I mean, they have corrections all the time, but they also are very careful about their stories. And this morning, I had a news alert that said Trump and Clinton are neck and neck. That and actually, if you read it, it says it's 46-44 Clinton-Trump. How would you sort of break that down? How would you teach us to read that kind of poll and get out of it what we should to be, you know, sort of critical voters in the election?
Well, there's so much to say about polls. The first thing is that if the poll doesn't report the margin of error, just ignore it, because it's either somebody trying to hoodwink you or whoever's handling the story doesn't know enough about polls to be writing about it. So you need to have a margin of error. Typically, in the kinds of national polls we're seeing, the margin of error is 3%. So what were the numbers you used? 42 and 40?
46, 44.
So those are only 2 percentage points apart. And I'm willing to make an educated guess that it's a 3% margin of error, meaning that those two numbers are statistically indistinguishable. One person's not ahead of the other. And you might find a report that has a poll that has a margin of error of 5% or 10 or 100%.
How would you design a 100% margin of error poll?
Well, I'll tell you. I have an adorable dachshund named Winifred, and she is the leading candidate for mayor of San Jose with a margin of error of 100%.
Good.
Vote Winifred.
I'll vote. That's great. I love dogs. And then this poll also said that those were pulled by likely voters. How do you even, like...
Let's take a brief... you know all this, but let's, just for the sake of fun, let's take a brief excursion into sampling theory. Don't worry. You don't need to put on your seatbelts, and there won't be any math. The idea is that you can capture what a large number of people feel about something, or, you know, other things like height or IQ or income, without talking to every single person in the group you're interested in. You sample. But one of the assumptions here is that everybody you're interested in this case, you know, American voters, has to be equally likely to be contacted by you. That's what we call random sampling. We don't talk to everybody because it's too expensive and time-consuming and it's impractical. But so we do a sample. And if the sample is well-designed, then everybody has an equal probability of being part of your poll. So I don't think you'd take seriously a poll where I just stood in front of the offices of the Republican National Committee and asked people who walked out who they were going to vote for. That seems biased. But it's actually more subtle. If I try to poll people using landlines, there's evidence that that will tend to skew towards older voters. If I use cell phones, it may tend to skew towards younger voters. Maybe I'll walk around Union Square to see how San Franciscans are going to vote.
Who in this room has been polled in the election?
Interesting.
Okay.
So maybe I'll walk around Union
Square. They're a statistically significant sample of the entire population, obviously.
Right. I walk around Union Square at I don't know, 11 in the morning. I'm getting people who are walking around, not people who are at their desks at work, right? So that might enter a bias into all of this. It turns out making a random sample is really, really difficult. And that's one of the reasons that the polls seem to be vacillating so much. So you want to look at the margin of error. You want to have some assurance from the pollster that this was a random sample. And the New York Times, CBS News, some of the better reporting organizations will tell you this is how we did it. We did it a combination of landlines and cell phone lines and mail-in surveys and stopping people on the street. But then there's something we call response bias. The kinds of people who will actually take the time to stop and talk to a pollster may not be representative of all the voters. And then the final problem with all of this is that we've got an election where, as in many elections, where the candidate that people may actually end up voting for when they're all alone in the room on November 8th may not be the candidate they tell you they're going to vote for, either because they want to impress you or they want to shock you or they just want to get rid of you or new information comes to light about the health of one of them in the next couple of months and they change their minds.
Very possible. There was another number that I saw today that I wanted to run by you. As I was going through your book, I was seeing all these numbers and how you sort of deconstruct them and sort of break them down into, all right, well, here's what's actually plausible, here's what's not plausible, here's what this leaves out. This is a number that is very near and dear to everyone in this room, and it is the average price of an apartment in San Francisco. I know it's true because it came from rentjungle.com, the first link on Google, so that's usually a good sign.
Well, let's talk about the first link on Google a little later.
I figured you would have an opinion on that. So $3,866, or that's the average, but for one bedroom, around $3,367.
Well, so we hear averages so often that many of us don't stop to think that about what that an average is. An average is a distortion. It has to be because you're taking a whole bunch of numbers and collapsing them into a single number, and it tells you very little about the range. So suppose I tell you that there's a room next door to us here with 10 people in it, and the average net worth of people in that room, let's say, of 10 people, is $5 billion each. Now, there might be reasons you'd want to go to that room if you were a salesperson of luxury boats or high-end automobiles, or you were a stockbroker or a bum looking for a handout, or you know, any number of reasons you might want to be in that room. And the way, of course, we come up with an average like that, if we're talking about the mean, is we add up the net worth of each person, we divide by the number of people. Now, what if I tell you that that room has Mark Zuckerberg net worth $50 billion and 9 indigent people net worth zero, right? The average is $5 billion, the mean, which is a number that doesn't describe the net worth of anybody in the room, right? And it really, it doesn't characterize the range or the... What an interesting thing about that room is another kind of average we use called the mode. The mode is the most common number, and that's zero. So that tells you, if you have both, then you know that something's up. Polling organizations, news media rarely report the mean and the mode, as well as the median, which is another measure. Half the people are above it, half are below it. And they should. It was just, you probably read a report just a few days ago that the median income of Americans just rose.
Because there are more rich people.
Right.
Or more,
I don't know. What does that actually mean? It's hard to say.
Or people left the country. We have no idea. Yeah. I mean, like, it's the possibilities are really endless with that one.
Yeah, I have an example of the median. Suppose you've got five people in the room and you ask them to empty their pockets to see how much money they have. So, and let's suppose they've got, respectively for the five, $0, $0, $3, $4, and $5. So the average now in that room, the mean, that kind of average, is 2.4. I worked it out ahead of time. The median is 3, 0, 0, 3, 4, 5. Half the people have more than 3, that's the 4 and the 5. Half the people have less, that's the 0 and 0. Now, suppose Mark Zuckerberg's in the room, and he happens and we take out the person who had $5 and we replace him with Zuckerberg, who happens to have, I don't know, $5 million on him. The median doesn't
change. He carries it around.
Right. The median doesn't change. The median is still 3. So you can see that none of those numbers really tells you all that you want to know.
Right.
But next time you see an average, ask yourself, which one are they giving me, and are they telling me anything about the range, and are they telling me anything about the other averages, because that's what I need to know to evaluate it. So especially if they're making a claim.
I think a lot about misleading numbers in my job. Since I'm a reporter on financial companies, we're just a business reporter on I cover social media companies primarily. And one thing that is extremely
common. You cover anti-social media companies?
Ooh, that's a good one. Maybe Reddit? I don't know.
Ask me anything.
No offense to Reddit. I love Reddit. Whatever. The thing that is really common in tech is reporting of an adjusted profit, right? So it's earnings per share, excluding some items,
write-offs,
and the some items is you know, some of it's like depreciation, amortization, whatever, intangibles, but it's also a large chunk of it is stock compensation for employees. And if you ask anyone in tech if stock compensation is a material part of retention and growth of their company, they'd probably say yes, but it's still not included in their EPS. And so I brought Twitter's numbers for you. So in the second quarter, the EPS was 13 cents. The adjusted EPS was 13 cents a share.
EPS is earnings per share.
Earnings per share, 13 cents a share, or $92.9 million in the quarter. But if you went by generally accepted accounting principles, which includes all the bad stuff they don't want to include, they actually lost 15 cents a share, or $107.2 million. So, and I don't mean to pick on Twitter. I mean every company is doing it. 80% of the tech companies in the S&P 500 have some sort of proprietary or personalized, whatever, earnings.
Can you summarize the Twitter problem in 140 characters or less?
Twitter doesn't include... I can. I'm not going to do it for you right now. But, but you know, how as consumers of this kind of information, what you mentioned on polling, what you've seen in your research, how can we hold people accountable better?
Well, so let's get practical about this. I think to begin with, a lot of people are intimidated by numbers, and they see a number and they kind of glaze over. They don't know what to do with it. In other cases, people, I think, believe that numbers are facts. And they're incontrovertible. They believe that statistics are facts, and they're not. Numbers and statistics are collected by humans. They're collected by storytellers who work for the company, or storytellers who are journalists, who are trying to tell a more accurate story, ideally. So the numbers are not incontrovertible. And there are biases that enter into their collection and their reporting. We need to be aware of those. But one thing we can do is read websites like factcheck.com, PolitiFact, certainly for anything that has to do with politics, and some of these big stories about corporations are political. Those websites will help you wade through it. Bloomberg News, New York Times Financial Section, Wall Street Journal. A good reporter will do just what you did and pick this apart and say, you know, this is what they're telling us, but if you actually look at the balance sheet and you work out the numbers yourself, this is what you'd really get. And I think that the lesson here is that when you see a number, don't just assume that it's accurate or that it's true or that it's the whole story. Now, you might be saying, why do I have to do this for myself? Shouldn't somebody be doing this for me? Wikipedia should be doing this for me, or the news media. Well, the news media are working as hard as they can, but they're having a hard time keeping up because there's so many lies swirling about, and there's so many more liars than there are journalists. That, you know, we all have to do a little bit of this ourselves. And I think it's a noble...
And anyone can be a journalist.
Well, right. It's just, you know...
Or not a journalist, but anyone can be a writer on the internet.
Well, that's the problem. Just because you have a cell phone doesn't make you a photographer. And just because you've got a Twitter account or a blog doesn't make you a journalist.
These or maybe it does, because people can read what you write and people can see your photos and...
Well, I still think that the word journalism refers to a profession that requires training and a certain skill set. The same as being a lawyer. Yes, you can serve as your own lawyer.
What about the guy who got the cell phone video of Hillary Clinton feeling a little faint at the 9/11 rally? Was, you know, he committed an act of journalism.
He's somebody who is a documentarian, documenting events. Mm-hmm. But a journalist, he contributed to the journalistic enterprise, but a journalist would have talked to people who were at the scene and tried to find out if there was an alternative explanation for what we're seeing. I mean, for all we know, there was a pothole that she stepped in that's not shown in the video. I mean, there are a lot of explanations that a journalist would get to. It took, you know, when the Syrian crisis first emerged, not the refugee crisis, but the chemical weapons crisis first emerged, the stories that first came out on Twitter were alarming, and they were it led us to believe certain things that later turned out not to be true, because the stories were being reported by locals who hadn't actually seen anything themselves and were relying on other people who hadn't seen it, so it was hearsay. It took a troop of journalists who arrived days later to sort through what actually happened.
One moment, as you're pondering that, just remember that if you're submitting questions, to do it through the app, which is a new thing that Inform is trying. So just keep that in mind. And I think the instructions are somewhere there. I want to know who you think is going to buy your book. Because it seems like the people who need to know this are not the people who are going to buy your book. Is this like the joke gift that you give to your aunt who like is always posting the latest diet craze on her Facebook? Like who you give this book to? Without being totally insulting.
Right. No, of course not. I never really think about who's going to buy my books in the way that when I was a record producer, I never really thought about who was going to buy the records. I just do what I enjoy, and I do what I think I would want to read or music I would want to listen to. And then sometimes it turns out what I want to read and listen to is what other people want to read and listen to, and maybe other times it's not. But to give you that's the true...
Your publisher's thinking about it, though, like a little bit?
Well, I'll tell you who my publisher thinks is going to buy the book.
Okay.
So we've already had a number of course adoptions by high school classes and college classes.
Good.
Business schools, UC Berkeley Business School, the Haas School of Business is going to be using the book for executive education, for intensive programs where they train executives who want to come back to school for 3 days and learn more about decision making and big data and critical thinking. And in all seriousness, I think that anybody who is interested in critical thinking and already employs it might be interested in the book because it serves as a kind of a refresher. It has some interesting examples from the news.
Yeah.
It puts a lot of stuff in one place, and it's a humorous book. It's as you pointed out, it's sort of written as a how to lie to people guide, but that's tongue in cheek, of course.
Of course.
And I hired the cartoonist who draws the.
I was saying it, or is it? I don't know.
Well, I hired the cartoonist who draws the bizarro comic strip, which is in 300 daily newspapers. He drew some cartoons to accompany the text to lighten it up a bit. And then the other thing that I'm really hopeful about is that I think that critical thinking is really the key to ending the sense of powerlessness that a lot of people in the lower economic classes feel. There's a big swath of Americans who feel powerless, who feel as though they can't get ahead. And I think one of the reasons they're unable to get ahead is they don't think critically about how to budget their money or how to save money. Or, you know, you find a lot of people who make irrational decisions because they haven't been trained to do evidence-based decision-making. Their parents or their teachers might have told them that they're not qualified to do so, which is ridiculous.
Or discourage them from doing it. I mean, right. There's, you know, I've read a lot in this election cycle about this sort of wave of anti-intellectualism. And how do you reach those people? Like, if you have somebody, you know, maybe in your extended family or a friend of a friend who you meet at a dinner and they just won't budge on something. What's the way to get through?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways, but I think the one that I've been thinking of as the most powerful lately is this idea that evidence-based decision-making leads to better life outcomes. It's associated with increased longevity, better health outcomes, happier life, and I think that's the message to push, that, you know, using evidence to form your decisions is the way to go, and critical thinking is what allows you to do that.
But what was the margin of error on that? I mean, how do you even measure happiness? Finding some flaws with that claim, I'm just going to say.
Well, so there's a branch of social psychology that measures social and personality psychology.
No, I'm with you. It's fine.
Yeah.
I just wanted to circle back to our main point.
You're asking exactly the right question. But they measure things
like
how happy you are with surveys, and they might have some physiological measures and some brain scans, and then they look at your patient records, and they look at longevity and things and health. And it turns out that of the thousands of ways that we human beings differ from one another, they can be mathematically divided into five clusters of traits. It doesn't mean there are only five kinds of people. That's completely ridiculous. But there are these five mathematical clusters called the big five factor structure of personality. And one of them is conscientiousness. And conscientiousness is associated with things like doing what you say you're going to do and being on time, and, you know, having a doctor, paying your taxes. It's associated with doing better in school because you actually complete the assignments.
Yeah.
And it's associated with, conscientiousness is associated with being evidence-based in your decision-making process. So through this, the research evidence, the margin of error is that these are based on studies where they're using, to be statistical, a 5% probability level for significance.
How do we parse through things on a more superficial level when we look through our Facebook feeds, our Twitter feeds, our snaps? I mean, we're not getting news through Snapchat that much yet, but what do you feel is the effect of social media on how we feel about what is true in the world?
Well, you probably read the headlines a few weeks ago that an increasing number of people under the age of 25 report they get all their news from Facebook. You know, what, as somebody who tracks social media, what was your first reaction to that?
I think, you know, you listen to Facebook's earnings call, they did get asked the echo chamber question. And they responded that Facebook is, and over, they respond that Facebook is supposed to just be a reflection of our real world. You know, is it more frequent that you're getting informational input? Yes. But is your overall circle of people you can connect to wider? Also, yes. And in the overall circle, are the chances that there are people who have differing opinions from you greater? Yes. But I think that fails to take into account that people are selecting the stuff they want to hear, and Facebook's newsfeed algorithm does prioritize showing you stuff that you will click on. So in the end, we're training it to tell us what we think will be interesting.
And what we might already know. So suppose that you are a climate change denier, and all your friends are climate change deniers, and you wake up one morning, you think, oh, I'm going to engage in some critical thinking. I want to know what the other side says, the people who believe that climate change is real. It's going to be harder and harder to do that with Facebook because you've effectively trained an artificial intelligence network to only reverberate, to create an echo chamber about the stuff that you're interested in. And Google is complicit in this too. I don't think intentionally, but the last time I go to Google regularly, I have colleagues and collaborators there. And the last time I was there, they boasted that they've achieved a new record of being able to have the search results. You put something in the search window, you get a list of results. The new record is that people are more likely than ever before to click on the first one. Now, those of you who have used the internet for a long time, you probably remember in the early days, you'd put in a search and you might have to go down 10 or 20, maybe even to the second page before you found the thing that you were looking for. But Google's been working really hard all this time to make sure that the very thing that you want is the first one. So again, if you're a climate change denier and you've been reading a lot of stuff about how climate change is hogwash, and then you wake up one morning and you want to see the other side, you put it in a search window, Google's not going to return that to you. Unless you really work it hard and keep manipulating your search terms. So the irony here is that the great promise of the internet for democracy and critical thinking and free speech was that it would allow us to become exposed to views that we might not otherwise encounter. And I mean, I think that's one of the great things about universities and big cities, and indeed one of the great things about free speech in a democracy is that at some point you may come across an idea you had never heard before. It may interest you. It may even affect decisions that you make. And I'm not just talking about political ideas, but you know, intellectual ideas. And yet we've created this internet where it's getting harder and harder to find ideas that are not, new to you.
How responsible is Twitter for the rise of Donald Trump?
You know, I'm not a political scientist, and I don't really. I say this because one of my hobby horses lately is that experts go on the radio or they hold public talks like this, and they're eager to give their opinions about things that are outside their area of expertise. And one of the things I say in the book is that one of the ways you can be a critical thinker, if you feel that you don't have the ability to track down everything that you read and you don't know how to go about it or you don't have the time, find an expert and see what they have to say. And I devote a whole section of the book to identifying expertise. And somebody who's an expert in, say, the economy isn't necessarily an expert in chemistry. But you have Nobel Prize winners in economics talking about chemistry or physics or, you know, things like that. The worst case was a local case here in the San Francisco Bay Area. The Nobel Prize winner in physics, William Shockley, who worked at Stanford, developed deeply offensive, racist, inaccurate views that one segment of American society was genetically inferior to another and had a lower IQ. He had no training in genetics or in intelligence assessment, but I think he got traction because people thought, oh, he's a physicist. He must be really smart. And he won a Nobel Prize. But, you know, so you've asked me a question about the rise of a political candidate owing to a particular social media outlet. I think it's a question for a political scientist or a sociologist, and
okay.
I don't feel qualified.
Well, I'll ask you a different one then. How responsible, what kind of responsibility should these companies take for all of the misinformation on their platforms?
Well, now
this is
an interesting question. So, and I think it's different. I think to begin to answer the question, one wants to make a distinction between a clearinghouse or a platform for free speech, which is what Twitter and Facebook are, and a genuine news organization like the New York Times, the Washington Post, Bloomberg, CNN, NPR, you know, the ones that we trust. So I think it's important to make a distinction because I think that the genuine news organizations have a responsibility to us to do fact-checking, to look at various sides and alternative explanations, to really function like a judge and jury and courtroom where a claim comes in and they try to assess the believability of the witness, right? I mean, a reporter is not, a legitimate reporter isn't going to run with a story if they think the witness was unreliable.
Yeah.
Just the way a judge or a jury aren't going to weight the testimony of an unreliable witness. But when you talk about Twitter or Facebook, this feels to me more like the community bulletin board, where people in the old days could, you know, just put up a note or a flyer and they could use a thumbtack and it was supposed to be open to all and it's supposed to be uncensored, or the old town square. And so the question is, if I could reframe the question, it's what responsibility do these clearinghouses have to take on the additional function of journalists or to weed out offensive speech? And I think the same question has been asked of universities lately, and we've got all this controversy about trigger warnings, and should universities allow hate speech or racist speech?
I think that's really different, though.
Is it?
Yeah, because universities, I mean, you're being presented with a lot of primary sources, a lot of academic writing, and on Facebook and Twitter, it's just kind of anyone can say anything that goes viral. And so,
should they be allowed to?
Yeah, well, not should they be allowed to, but if what they say goes viral and it's wrong, then, you know, somebody has to say that it's wrong. And what do they do? Do they remove it? Do they mark it as wrong? Facebook's really struggling with this right now. Yeah. They're trying to be able to mark inaccurate content more readily, but the popularity of information in their network sometimes trumps it. Like when they decided to stop having...
Was that a plug for one of the candidates?
No. That was not so when they got rid of human editors on their trending topics, in the first week there were two inaccurate stories. One was like a fake news story about Megyn Kelly, the Fox News anchor. There was another one that was like a 9/11 truther, and this was the algorithm deciding this is what people were sharing.
Well, here's what I think. I think that the one solution to this is that if all of us become more conscious of what critical thinking entails, we seek out experts. We spend 20 or 30 seconds before we hit the forward button to check out whether this has been debunked or shown to be untrue. I think that we can all do it ourselves, and I think that as the lot of us become more educated, more willing to practice critical thinking, then it'll be less likely that stuff that is untrue will get a lot of traction. And I think journalists have a role to play there, but so do we.
And so when you go about, after the book is published, like what do you hope happens? Does anything change? Like, do people become more truthy? Do companies change the way they promote information? Like what is different about the world?
Well, I guess people have been lying for as long as there's been people. I mean, there was lies and deception in the Old Testament. The Trojan horse was a lie, right? I mean, you go back to ancient Greece. So it's not that lies are something new, and it's not that we're going to eradicate them, but I see it as kind of an arms race between the liars and the rest of us, where the liars get a little bit better at lying, and we have to get, gather some tools that we can use to detect when they're lying, and then they have to try a different way to lie, and then we get some better tools. And so I see the book as basically furnishing some really practical tools. And my hope is that it will accomplish two things. It will raise the level of discourse in this country to talk about evidence as opposed to a bunch of pseudo-evidence or falsehoods, so that we can make intelligent decisions based on facts that we all agree on. My additional hope is that it will empower people to realize that they're smarter than they may have been told, or that they can have some control over what they believe and how they decide.
If there is something that that shocked you the most in the last 6 months about sort of the way that people just accepted false information, what would it be? What examples do you feel stick out to you?
Well, what shocked me the most is when people use graphics to manipulate your perception. They'll use a graph or a chart. Sometimes they do it because they've got an agenda and they want to fool you. Other times they just don't know better. And, so there was a famous graph that was circulated in a congressional hearing, and somebody was testifying about Planned Parenthood. And the conversation was about how Planned Parenthood has an agenda to kill as many babies as, well, as many, abort as many fetuses as possible. And they showed a graph that over the last 10 years or so, along the x-axis, you see the amount of time that's elapsed, and on the y-axis, the vertical axis, you're seeing the amount of money that Planned Parenthood spent. And so from your perspective, going from the lower left to the upper right, you see the amount of money spent on abortions increasing precipitously. And Planned Parenthood also does cancer screenings for cervical cancer. And the amount of money they spent on cervical cancer screenings over that same period dropped dramatically. So you've got another line for that going from the upper left to the lower right, and it makes a big letter X. And it really looks like they've ramped up their spending on the abortions and, really stopped spending money on cancer. And it plays into the argument that, boy, they must really not be actually interested in women's health. So it turns out that this is one of those graphs where the axes aren't labeled. So that tells you something. But I think the graph maker must have felt a little guilty, because he or she put the actual numbers next to the 4 points, the 4 endpoints of these lines. And if you look carefully, and I'm sure most people didn't, but because you just look at a graph and you think, oh, well, I'm taking the picture. This is the story it's telling. If you look closely, the high amount of money on abortions is a number that's lower than the low amount of money on cancer screening. So it really should look like a letter V on its side. The amount of money they spent on abortions at its peak was actually much less than the amount of money they spent.
So it was just completely wacky. Like it was.
Yes. And then even then, the fact is that the abortion spending went up a little bit and the cancer spending went down a little bit, but they had an explanation for that. It was that, as you may know, screening guidelines for cervical cancer changed during that period, and it was recommended by the AMA and other physician groups that they should do far less screening because it was leading to a lot of negative outcomes. So it was no longer warranted or justified for a whole bunch of women in a low-risk category. And the simple reason that abortions went up was attributed to a demographic bump. There were more women seeking Planned Parenthood counseling, but the number of abortions per visitor to Planned Parenthood hadn't gone up. So it's that shocked me, that kind of bald-faced deception was out there in Congress, right, where you would expect evidence to rule.
We got some laughs on that one.
Sarah?
I think we have some questions.
Yes. And actually, I'm going to ask two of the question submitters to join me at the microphone to ask their questions. And I will read some of the anonymous questions for Dan to answer.
Very nice.
So if I could have Connor Mitchell and Alexander Sanchez join me at the microphone.
Yay, Connor and Alexander.
Snaps. I guess that's the thing to do.
And I'll let them kick it off, and then we'll go to some of the anonymous questions.
All right. Some things people are too embarrassed to ask.
Hi. Okay, my question is, what is your opinion of Malcolm Gladwell and his books? Are the ideas he argues for well-supported, or are they just exaggerations?
Very good.
That's a great question. I have to say that Malcolm Gladwell is one of the finest writers, I believe, in the English language. I think the best English language essayist on the planet alive today is Adam Gopnik, who also writes for The New Yorker. See, terrific writer, and in fact, I often find myself crying at the beauty of his writing and also at the realization that I will never be that good. Malcolm is a great writer, too. The thing I prefer about Adam is that Adam is very scrupulous about getting his facts right and about getting both sides of the story. Malcolm is more of a storyteller, and he's more interested in what facts will allow him to be a storyteller. And in that respect, he's more like the documentarian Oliver Stone, who has said that he doesn't feel it's his job to portray the facts in an objective way, Oliver Stone has said. It's his job to tell a good story. And if he's got to leave some facts out in order to tell that story, he'll do that. And I haven't heard Malcolm say this, but I have the sense that this is the way he operates. I do love his writing, and I think some of his pieces are extraordinarily good and very, very accurate. But he's also done some damage. In particular, the damage that he did with his book, in which he claimed that dyslexia might actually be an advantage, is a really grotesque reading of the scientific literature. And I say it's grotesque because what it's saying to parents and children is, if you have dyslexia, leave it untreated, because there are a few notable cases of people who excelled and they had dyslexia, so clearly the dyslexia must have caused their success. But as you know, there's a lack of a control group there. How much more successful might they have been if they had not, you know, if they had had their dyslexia cured or remediated in some fashion? We don't know. So, you know, that he's done that kind of damage in a few cases, and it's troubling to me. But you know, you can't. He's such a skillful and persuasive writer.
So, Dean Dan, my question for you is, which sources do you use to get your news and why?
So, this is me now just talking as a regular person, not as an expert on what the best sources are. I don't read the National Enquirer and TMZ, and because I figure that although they occasionally get stuff right, like TMZ broke the story of Michael Jackson before anybody else did, because they were willing to run with one source. Everybody else wanted two or three. I figure if TMZ or the Enquirer get something right, you know, sooner or later, the other major newspapers will come around and get it. I just read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I listen to CNN and NPR. I know that some have claimed that these sources, not the Wall Street Journal, but the others, have a left-leaning bias. But I've read several studies that you know, by presumably objective sources, you know, university departments of communication and media studies, who say they don't actually have a bias. I figure that my own experiences with the New York Times, they've reported on 17 different they've reported on my research 17 different times over the years, and I've written for them, and I found their fact-checking to be very scrupulous, sometimes a pain in the neck scrupulous. And so I trust them. And they're wrong a lot of the time. According to one estimate I read recently, they only get 58%, a score of 58% accurate. But they're the most accurate newspaper in the country and arguably in the world. So it's percentages for me. I want to see I want to spend my time reading the one that's most likely to be accurate. By the way, I follow business news on Bloomberg, on the TV show, and on the website.
Very good.
I read the Huffington Post. But if I see something on Facebook or Twitter because a friend posted it, the very next move I make is to go to one of those trusted sources and see if they've reported on it. Now, the price I pay for this is that I'm usually a day behind in the news. But I figure I don't want to clutter my head full of stuff that that might not be true. I'm willing to wait a day for stuff. And I'm at the age also where I'm beginning to feel that every time I learn something new, it pushes out something old I used to know. Like the time I took that home winemaking course and then forgot how to drive. Just kidding. Memory doesn't really work that way. I just went for the laugh. But yes, does that help?
Yeah, thank you.
It's kind of opposite not opposite, but when I see a news story that's breaking, I always try to find who reported it first. Because as a journalist,
right.
You know, I'm very sensitive to the, you know, when things get aggregated sometimes, there's a whole telephone effect.
Yeah.
That's
interesting.
Where it might be interpreted. So like I'll click on the link, but then I'll click on the link that was linked in the link, you know.
But so you're practicing proper journalism. You want to know who the source was, and
what
then
was
you
the
decide
a source of the aggregated piece, like
right.
See it on Vox or Business Insider or whatever.
And then how do you go about deciding whether the original source was reliable or not, as opposed to, you know, like just somebody who was drunk and making stuff up?
Sometimes I have an advantage being a reporter who knows other reporters. So I can say, oh, I've read this person's work before and that's been really good. And I know they have good sources, et cetera. But other times you kind of have to make a judgment. Like, does this seem like, you know, it has enough detail in it? Like a lot of stories these days are based on anonymous sources and you kind of have to decide like, okay, does this have enough like meat in it to really be true?
I'll tell you an interesting story. The very first interview I ever did for anything, to the best of my recollection, was I was commenting on an article for the New York Times about a scientific paper. They called me and asked me to comment on a scientific paper that had been published. And I spent about 2 hours with this reporter on the phone. I remember it because I was at Stanford at the time. And I walked this reporter through a field that he didn't know anything about, and I gave him the history of it, and I explained to him how the experiment was done and what the flaws were. And I said, so, you know, this thing that you're, this paper that was reported, it doesn't seem as though the experiment was properly done. It wasn't rigorous. I've already talked to some other people in the field, and none of us think that this should have been published, but occasionally stuff gets through. And he said, yeah, but if I tell the story, he says, I'm a young reporter. I haven't been working here at the New York Times long. If I tell the story that way, I'm not going to get a front page headline. And
what?
I have a chance with this of getting a front page headline.
That's
and
disappointing.
I was so disappointed. And he still works there. And so whenever I see his byline, I think, I'm not going to read this.
Interesting. Next question.
So we're going to go to the anonymous. So if you hear your question, congratulations. The next top-ranked question, so these have been upvoted, actually, by folks here. So what can we rely on? Is skepticism the only thing we can rely on when receiving information today?
I don't like the word skepticism because I think critical thinking means that you don't just skeptically reject every claim you encounter. And of course, you want to avoid the opposite extreme of gullibly accepting everything. I think you just ask follow-up questions. I think critical thinking entails wanting to know the source, wanting to figure out if it's plausible, if there are other sides to the story, if maybe there's a frame to the story that's causing you to be misled somehow. I'll give you an example, if I may. How many of you remember the claim that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate? Big ad campaign. Now, what does it make you think of in terms of one of the competing toothpastes that the dentists didn't like it, right? Well, it turns out Colgate got sued because everybody thought that that's what it implied. And in reality, the dentists were asked to list all of the toothpaste they recommend. And 4 out of 5 of them recommended Colgate, but they recommended a whole bunch of others too, right? So this is it's not that you're being skeptical, it's that you're trying to get more information. What question was asked? Who asked the question? Who were these dentists that they asked? Were they people who still had their license? Were they people who had been kicked out? Were they, you know, were they people who were on the payroll of the company doing the survey?
There was that big report recently on sugar.
This is so awful in that it sets, for those of you who didn't read it, it turns out that a group of Harvard researchers accepted money from the sugar industry to report that sugar was not a major cause of obesity, but instead saturated fats were. And it's true, saturated fats were, but the whole point was to publish articles that downplayed the role of sugar. And this sets back science 30 years. There are a whole bunch of people who I can assure you are going to say, oh, those scientists, they're all corrupt. I can't believe anything they say. Climate change must not be true. There really must be evidence that Elvis is still alive and has a 3-headed alien baby. And, I mean, they're just throwing everything out. It's terrible when this happens.
Yeah.
Since 1984, there have been stronger ethical guidelines in place about reporting
financial.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to have 2 more folks come up. Eric Lynn and Stefan Kinn.
Yay, Eric and Stefan.
And in the meantime, I'm going to ask one of the anonymous questions. Are there any stories where there was a big impact as a result of false information that people may not be aware of, something that you might have come across in your research?
Well, I think one of the big ones that people still aren't aware of is the link between the link or lack of a link between autism and the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
So this has been a big controversy and continues to be. There was a study done a long time ago, years ago, that purported to show a link between children getting this vaccine and then later developing autism. And it turns out the data were fabricated. Andrew Wakefield, the physician who fabricated the data, lost his license. His papers were retracted. But this thing still has a life of its own. And it, every once in a while, it starts being widely distributed on social media. The parents don't vaccinate your kids. And it's a case where, as a cognitive neuroscientist, I'm really fascinated by the way the brain works. And there's this well-known bias or foible, which is that as soon as we acquire a piece of information, we cling to it. It's called belief perseverance, even when the original evidence that caused you to form that belief is taken away. And I'll tell you, it's like climate change. There's no credible source who believes that there is a link between autism and the vaccine. And there's no credible source who thinks that climate change is not real. If you look hard enough, you'll find some people who believe the wrong thing, but they're not trained in the field. And in the interesting thing and tragic thing with the autism controversy is that there was a kind of experiment performed by the public, which would have been a perfect scientific experiment, but utterly unethical to perform. And that is that a whole bunch of parents stopped administering the vaccine to their kids, right? Which is a controlled experiment in a way. Except that we didn't randomly tell people who to, you know, vaccinate, not vaccinate. But as a result of this, epidemics of measles broke out in certain communities in the United States and England, and the autism rate stayed the same. So you increased substantially the risk of people to measles, mumps, and rubella, and didn't change the autism rates at all. And this is just tragic. It's a failure of critical thinking, and it was one of the things that surprised me that this thing still has legs.
I remember reading this article of this guy who got a peer-reviewed study published where he was just like, we're going to make this study about chocolate because people write about chocolate. And we're just gonna like track people eating chocolate for like a couple weeks and see what is the statistically significant change. I'm curious what you even think when you read something as statistically significant.
Well, so I don't put too much stock in a single study, and no scientist does. And this is something that some of the media get and other members of the media don't. In science, one study doesn't tell you anything. What really tells you something is what we call a meta-analysis, where somebody who's qualified goes through and looks at 10 or 20 or 200 studies on the topic. And the idea is that if the effect is really there that you're looking for, if this drug really will cure cancer, or if chocolate really will lead to longevity, it's going to show up in more than one study. It's going to show up in a group of studies done by different labs and on different people in different ways with different protocols. And that's when you can believe something.
All right, next question.
How can one teach people who don't have access to critical thinking education about like how they can interpret current news and media?
Well, I think we try to encourage them to ask the question, is how do I know if this is true? To teach them when you land on a web page, that's not the end of the research enterprise. It's only the beginning. Then you have to start asking, who operates this web page? Might there be biases? There are a couple of quick tricks if you want them. One is use the link tool in Google search. So if you end up at a web page called martinlutherking.org and you're trying to figure out who runs it or something about its legitimacy, type in link:martinlutherking.org, and what you'll discover, Google will return all the pages that link to it, and what you'll discover is it's kind of a shill web page for the Ku Klux Klan. It's not actually giving you objective information about that great civil rights leader. So that's one thing you can do. And the other is use scholar.google.com for anything having to do with science or medicine, because it'll return articles that have primarily been vetted through peer review.
All right. Thank you.
And then this is going to be our last question.
Last but not least, thank you very much for your talk. I enjoyed it much. So essentially my question, I want to turn it on its head a little bit, but to deal with evidence paralysis, how do you develop an intuition to see what kind of sources, what kind of evidence is the one that you want to look at? For example, in this time-constrained world, we know that we're getting bombarded constantly with so much facts, so much like information. How do you deal with that? Thank you.
Well, I think one component of this is trusting experts, but not over-trusting them. So, you know, I mentioned Shockley before as an example of somebody who traversed outside their area of expertise. Be wary when you see that on TV. And be wary of somebody who is yelling at you when they're delivering the news.
Or just yelling at their co-anchors.
Yeah.
All right, I guess that's it. Thank you very much.
And now for a Noon Forum tradition. You've been warned. Your 60-second idea to change the world.
Boy, well, there are a lot of things I'd like to do to change the world. I'd like to see the end of poverty and hunger. And I'd like to see us deal with the results of climate change. I'd like to see the end of aggressions and racism. And this is a tall order. I think that the way to change the world is the current generation of students, people who are between 12 and 22 years old. I think they're going to change the world. I think the world is in good hands. And I think the way they're going to do that is through critical thinking. And I'm putting my money where my mouth is by being a dean at Minerva, because the Minerva Schools at the Keck Graduate Institute here in San Francisco has completely rewritten undergraduate curriculum and education, focusing on critical thinking skills. And the whole point is to arm them with the tools they need to communicate effectively, to analyze statements for veracity, to use the information they acquire in creative ways to solve problems of the world and to make the world a better place.
All right, and with that, Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.